Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The Assembly of First Nations National Chief credits Prime Minister Justin Trudeau with doing more to improve the quality of life for First Nations people than any prime minister in Canada's history. At the same time, Trudeau's own former justice minister suggests Trudeau is to blame for what she calls a petty, toxic partisanship that hobbled his effectiveness. As his term comes to an end, we'll get an assessment of what Trudeau brought to the table for Indigenous people in Canada. That's right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The mayor of Anchorage, Alaska, has thrown her support behind the Aklutna tribe's effort to build a small casino on the outskirts of the city. The tribe sees gaming as an opportunity to create jobs and boost the economy. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the endorsement comes amid a lawsuit to block the project.
Only about 6.5 acres are involved, a native allotment that has become a test case of tribal sovereignty in Alaska. Governor Mike Dunleavy has asked President-elect Trump to reverse an Interior Department decision last year that cleared the way for the tribe to seek a permit for a gaming hall that would have up to 700 electronic slot machines. The BIA released its environmental assessment of the project recently, and it opened it up for public comment. In her written response, Mayor Suzanne LaFrance gave a wholehearted endorsement of the gaming hall, noting that the assessment found no significant concerns. She also cited the Aklutna tribe's track record for environmental stewardship. "We'd like to formally share our support for the native village of Aklutna," the mayor wrote, "as it exercises its sovereignty and pursues economic development." LaFrance says she has confidence in the tribe based on its relationship with the city.
"There is such an emphasis on listening, problem solving, and being very open about the situation. And so I feel like that's part of what makes the relationship so strong."
"It's really good to see Mayor LaFrance embracing what the tribes have to offer."
Longtime tribal advocates like attorney Sky Starkey say these kinds of endorsements are not unusual in the lower 48, but unprecedented in Alaska, where there's been an ongoing debate about whether tribes exist. Michelle Demert, an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Department of Tribal Governance, says she's glad to see the mayor acknowledge the importance of tribes.
"Tribes are really great partners. We bring in a lot of money. We bring in a lot of resources."
A group of neighboring property owners says the mayor shouldn't have endorsed the project without hearing from them first. In a lawsuit, they say the land does not have Indian country status and that the casino will hurt the rural character of their community. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has a new plan to strengthen its collaboration with tribes and help build more sustainable food systems. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Nationwide, there are 574 federally recognized tribes. Nearly half of them are in the West, where tribes manage or farm more than 55 million acres of land. The USDA's new strategy aims to help tribes better protect and preserve the natural resources and farmland they rely on. That includes dedicating more staff and funding to conservation across tribal lands and incorporating Indigenous knowledge into that work. Roylene Comes at Night is a conservationist with the agency and a member of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana.
"This gives us an opportunity to now build this tribe by tribe, and so that each tribal nation that has their own concerns can adopt and adapt those concerns to meet their needs."
She says overall the new strategy supports tribes' cultural and farming traditions and will make sure their priorities and knowledge shape future federal policies. I'm Caleb Radel.
The United American Indian Involvement, an urban Indian organization in Los Angeles, California, is offering support to those impacted by wildfires in the area. The organization's emergency response includes providing food, water, and temporary shelter to those in need. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
educators. Ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org, who support this show. Looking to exhibit, enhance, or share your artistic talents and cultural knowledge? Crazy Horse Memorial has artist residencies, performance opportunities, and more. Application deadline is January 31st at crazyhorsememorial.org, who support this show. Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Justin Trudeau is resigning his post as Prime Minister of Canada. He says he will stay in office until his party chooses a new leader. Trudeau's popularity has waned during his 9 years in office. After his announcement, Indigenous leaders praised him for making historic increases in spending and improving relations with the federal government. Others criticized his inability to deliver what he promised going into the job. Today on our show, we'll get First Nations perspectives on Trudeau's legacy and how Indigenous communities in Canada fared under his leadership. We also want to hear from you. What did you make of Trudeau's tenure? Do you follow First Nations issues in Canada? If so, join this conversation with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE, and you can also comment on our website or social media pages. Joining us from Toronto, Ontario, in Canada, is Russ Dibo. He is a policy analyst, and he is Ganawage Mohawk. Russ, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hello, thank you.
Also on the show today and joining us from Edmonton, Alberta, is Matthew Wildcat. He is an assistant professor of Native Studies, director of Indigenous Governance and Partnership at the University of Alberta, and he's a member of Ermineskin Cree Nation. Good morning, Matthew, and thank you also for joining our show today.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, Russ, I want to begin with you. And let's talk a little bit about Justin Trudeau and his impact. There was a huge, huge amount of optimism when he came into office. And now, 9 years later, here we are. How do you think Indigenous people in Canada view his legacy?
Well, it's mixed. Like you said in your introduction, there are leaders that are praising him, but he's also been criticized basically for not delivering. You know, in the 9 years that he headed up the government of Canada, he's made massive changes to policy, laws, and he restructured the government of Canada to create two departments instead of, you know, the old Department of Indian Affairs. He replaced them with two Indigenous departments, Indigenous Services Canada and Crown Indigenous Relations and Northern Affairs Canada. So, you know, these are massive changes that are unprecedented, certainly in my lifetime, and I'm in my 60s now. And people are still trying to make sense of all these changes that have come about.
Well, let's use that example, departments instead of one. Could you give us just because you wrote a really, really interesting article, and you went through some of these different changes, and it's very, very intense. It's very technical. Just giving us an example, like these two departments, was that a bad move to change from one department or two, or was it ineffective? How has that worked out?
Well, what he basically did is he cherry-picked the 1996 Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples report that cost $58 million a study. Kind of like the American Indian Policy Review they did after Wounded Knee in the 80s. It was massive. There were 440 recommendations. One of the recommendations was to replace Indian Affairs with these two departments to basically get rid of the Indian Act. But there were also other recommendations, like to have legislation recognizing treaties and land rights and other and to have a new royal proclamation like the Royal Proclamation in 1763, it recommended having a new one to recognize Aboriginal treaty rights. So he didn't include all of that. He just picked the recommendation to create these two departments. And one department, Indigenous Services Canada, its job is to build the capacity of, in Canada, we have a different situation than the States, right? We maintain the British colonial system. And when Canada had its constitution in 1867, in 1876, it passed the Indian Act. And so 148 years later, we have the Indian Act still in place. And it defines who Indians are, who bands are, who reserves are. And there's 600 bands and probably over 2,000 reserves, because some bands have more than one reserve. So by getting rid of the Department of Indian Affairs and setting up Indigenous Services Canada to provide services on reserve, it's to build the capacity for bands to move into self-government, Canada's definition of self-government, which is a municipal form of self-government. And that's what Crown Indigenous Relations' job is, to negotiate what they call modern treaties, or which are comprehensive land claims or self-government agreements. So that's what this two-track approach is with these two departments that he put in place during his administration. But, you know, they're basically using negotiation policies that date back quite a few years. The self-government policy, the land claims policies, and there's two, comprehensive claims and specific claims. And this additions to reserve policy. So they have a policy where if a band buys land, it has to go through this process of red tape to get the lands added to a reserve land base. So, you know, this is what the Trudeau government's been overseeing, is that they have this two-track approach to making changes.
Mm.
So that's what they've been doing. But some communities accept it and some don't, right? Mm-hmm. The definition of self-government that Canada's promoting.
So, what is it then that's led him to lose so much popularity with the greater Canadian population? How did we get to this point?
Well, you know, he was popular in the beginning because it was after 10 years of a Conservative government led by Prime Minister Stephen Harper. First Nations didn't like him either because he was cutting programs and ignoring rights and things like that. So when Trudeau came in, Canadians in general were looking for a change, because, you know, after 10 years, it's basically, I think, the shelf life in Canada of a government. Trudeau came in and talked about sunny ways and being optimistic. But over the years, he's introduced policies that, you know, I guess the conservative types didn't like. They felt were like in the States with the Republicans, right? They're saying he was too woke, and that they didn't like his policies on climate change, for example, especially, you know, Matthew could probably talk about that in Alberta, where they have an oil and gas-based economy. He was bringing in climate change policies, and he introduced a carbon tax on gas, which raised the prices, and the Conservatives point to that as raising inflation. And then the pandemic hit, and he introduced vaccine policies that a lot of people didn't like, and that led to a truck convoy occupying Ottawa. A lot of dissension occurred over the vaccine mandates and over the carbon tax. That's what the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, in Canada is calling for now, is a carbon tax election, because he wants to scrap that to reduce the costs, which he says are contributing to inflation. So generally, I think the public, it's the economy, you know, I think, and the mm-hmm. inflation, the cost of food, like in the States, you know.
Okay.
It's the cost of living that people are getting pretty angry about. And so that's where the Liberals and Trudeau himself, his popularity declined after 9 years.
You mentioned how there was a 10-year period there before Trudeau that was led by Conservatives, and now you just mentioned Pierre Poilievre, who is Conservative Party of Canada leader and a front runner possibly to be the next prime minister. If that happens, what do you see the impact for Indigenous people?
Well, according to the polling, it looks like he'll form the next government. You know, in Canada, we have a parliamentary system, not like the states. So when they have a general election and all these members of parliament are elected, whichever party forms the most, unless, you know, they can negotiate with another party to form a minority government. If they get a majority government, not only do they control the parliament, the legislature, the House of Commons, but they also control the executive branch of the government. It's a little different in the States because you got a president that, you know, that's separated from Congress and the Senate. In Canada, under the parliamentary system, they control, if it's a majority government, they control both branches of government, the legislative and the executive. They don't control the Senate, but they control the parliament. And so that means, you know, they'll basically be running these two new Indigenous departments and everything else, as well as being able to introduce legislation into parliament to amend things that Trudeau did. Basically, they can undo a lot of what Trudeau did through policy and through changes to spending. And they will. They put out a policy platform. It kind of mirrors what the Liberals are doing. They want to get rid of the Indian Act too, both parties. They want to replace it with, you know, this form of self-government that's municipal. They say they want to settle land claims, but they want to have what they call certainty and finality, which is another way of saying extinguishing rights. So, I mean, they've kind of shown their cards on where they're going to go. And it looks like they will be the next government. The Liberals under the polling, they'll be lucky if they survive with enough seats to form, have party status, according to recent polls. And with Trump putting the pressure on, talking about erasing the line between the U.S. and Canada, challenging Canada's territorial integrity, of course, as First Nations, we do too. But all of that's adding pressure onto the current Liberal government while they're having a leadership race until March. And then we'll go into an election. So, you know, all of this is got the country a bit in turmoil.
Okay.
Trump's getting sworn in on January 20th, right? What he's saying.
This is a lot to process. Yeah, Russ. We're going to have to take a short break here, but we're going to come back and continue this conversation. Really, really interesting. Justin Trudeau resigning his post as Prime Minister of Canada. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got a take on this issue, you can call us at 1-800-99-NATIVE. The federal government dedicated more than $1.3 billion toward affordable housing for Native Americans in the last year. That is aimed at making a dent in the substandard housing, overcrowding, and homelessness that affect Native people more often than other populations. We'll look at where that money goes, coming up on the next Native America Calling.
Our precious relatives, resolve to live better. Set realistic goals and list the steps you'll take to achieve them. Not sure where to start? Contact your local Indian health care provider, visit healthcare.gov/coverage, or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are getting an analysis of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's track record with Indigenous peoples in Canada by two First Nation political experts. If you're just now tuning in, we just heard from Russ Dibo, who is a policy analyst in Toronto, Ontario. And our next guest, Matthew Wildcat, is an assistant professor of Native Studies. He's based in Edmonton, Alberta. And of course, as a listener, you are more than welcome to join this conversation. Have you been following Indigenous issues in Canada? If so, let us know and join us with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. And let's go to Matthew now. And Matthew, I want you to comment on Trudeau's legacy and him stepping down. Did that surprise you at all? And what do you think the impact will be going forward in Canada?
Yeah. So I certainly agree with Russ. It's mixed, for sure. I was also taken aback by all of the national leaders of the three Indigenous organizations, the Inuit, Métis, and First Nations. All had kind of very glowing things to say about Justin Trudeau, and I wasn't expecting the level of generosity in their public comments that have been reported on in the news. This is what I think is kind of the defining thing of Justin Trudeau's tenure. Like, I think it's kind of undeniable that, he led a government that probably made more policy changes for Indigenous peoples than any time since the early 1970s when the government of Canada dropped their official policy of assimilation. So, of course, up until the early 1970s, the main policy that the government was pursuing was that First Nation and Indigenous people would end as legal and political entities, right? And of course, pursued genocidal tactics over the years in order to for Indigenous peoples to end, right? And in the very very early going, included like waging a war against Indigenous peoples out on the prairies, but also the legacy of residential schools is one in which there was significant loss of life of Indigenous children, right? And since this kind of official policy of assimilation ended in the 1970s, the federal government, I think, has been very, very reluctant to think through, okay, how is it that we recognize, the rights, the title, the political status of Indigenous nations and Indigenous people, right? And so you had this kind of great enthusiasm from the Trudeau government. He has this kind of famous line right off the bat: "There's no relationship more important to me than that with Indigenous people." All these kind of other symbolic gestures like Jody Wilson-Raybould being the Attorney General, the highest political position ever held by an Indigenous person in Canada. I also, probably their defining, their most important defining work was the passing of legislation around child welfare, recognizing the inherent jurisdiction of First Nations to control children's services, right? And even in my neck of the woods, the community I'm from, Musqueam, very early on in 2018, we signed what was quite a significant education funding package that, it increased core funding to our schools by over 80%, right? And, the overall funding only increased, I think, something around the range of 20%, but so much of that funding had to be scraped together through grants and special projects. And there's all these onerous reporting mechanisms. And, we have a distinct funding agreement where, it's not tied to any of those things. We're able to use those dollars how we best see fit. And the dollars increase significantly, right? I'll get to the point. The point is that I think where Justin Trudeau, where he got caught, was that he is both the leader of a democratic nation, but also a colonial nation at the same time. And I think he thought being more, the ability to think through these issues from a democratic standpoint of what justice looks like would end Canada also being a colonial nation and him also being the leader of a colonial country, right? But that's not the case. Those two things are both simultaneously true, that Canada is both democratic and colonial at the same time. And just because you lean more into initiatives which would seek to ameliorate historical injustices, it doesn't stop Canada from being colonial, right? And I think that is kind of the bottom line, is that at the end of the day, Canada remains colonial, and it's not willing to deal with that in a big picture sense.
Matthew, you briefly talked about core funding for schools, and let's talk more about spending toward issues that affect Indigenous peoples, because that nearly tripled under Trudeau from about $11 billion in 2015 up to $32 billion. Is that a meaningful figure?
Well, for some people, yes, absolutely, it's a meaningful figure. But, you know, I think the thing we have to realize is that money doesn't necessarily solve problems, right? Like, resources have to be translated into outcomes. And in order to translate resources into outcomes, you need also in place organizations, institutions, the transfer of actual control, like, the ability to make decisions. You know, all those things have to be in place in order for those resources to be spent effectively. So in some places, yes, I absolutely think, what I've heard from people is you have very real wins on the ground, right? And so, like, you know, in Muscogee's, we can point, have very clear metrics that students are better off today than they were in 2015. When Trudeau took power, right? And part of that, the main part of that is that, you know, we've made effective decisions and been effective stewards of resources in Muscogee's to see excellent outcomes. And we were going to do that whether there was funding or not, because there was a long, you know, a multi-decade record of success in Muscogee's around improving the quality of education in our schools. And it wasn't only tied to funding, but the funding made it easier. Right, and it unlocked a bunch of things which would otherwise have been very, very difficult to unlock. And so at the end of the day, you know, it really is about like the creating effective organizations, creating effective institutions. But at this, you know, at the same point, these dollar figures make all of this much, much easier to do. Otherwise, what would otherwise be a very hostile circumstance. I think the other thing though is, you know, is when we talk about those numbers, they you can break them down in all sorts of different ways, right? Because sometimes all those dollars don't necessarily trickle down to communities, and they're kind of sucked up by all these federal ministries, which have, you know, these kind of very large staffs and budgets, and so, you know, there. I think it again, on the one hand, yes, absolutely, it's a huge win. It has made a difference in many pockets of the country, but this kind of like these blunt figures of, you know, these huge increases in funding, they don't tell the whole story either.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. Let's go to the phones where we have Nicholas, who is in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's listening online. Nicholas, hello. Thank you for calling in. And what's your comment?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to thank you for your great program. I've listened to it over the past couple of months, and I've learned a lot about the U.S. as well. Both Matthew and Russ are speaking the facts, and I can only second what they're saying. Nothing I can really add to it, except as Matthew is pointing out, very few dollars actually hit the street level. You should see what Maine and Hastings and our slums hurt. They're looking a lot worse in Vancouver here now.
Mm. Nicholas, I'd like to ask you, what do you see as Justin Trudeau's legacy now going forward?
Unfortunately, very little. We had a lot of hope in him. I actually voted for him. I don't necessarily trust the other fellow. We have a saying here, left wing or right wing, it might be a part of the same vulture. Trudeau came in because the Conservatives weren't doing much. And then we see the same thing as well. He fired Jody Wilson when she was trying to have some integrity and do her job.
What do you think this says about the future of progressive politics, not only there in Canada, but also the United States and Europe as well?
I know I'm watching it globally. I work globally as one of the few First Nations investigators. I can work in Canada, U.S., as well as Indian territories with their permission. I wish something would be done by the PM about our Highway of Tears situation that's been going on here for decades. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. Educate us, please.
Oh, okay. A lot of women have gone missing on a certain highway in BC here. And over the past couple of decades, very little has been solved about it. I returned to work to try and help investigate that and stop it. I'm a junior elder with the Squamish Indian Nation. And they actually sent me through the Justice Institute for advanced training and investigations to try and help. But we don't see much get trickled down to the street level. Have you seen Vancouver
lately? I haven't been up to Vancouver in a number of years. But Nicholas, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate all of your insights. And I'm glad you're a fan of the show as well. Keep listening, okay?
Oh, yeah. I tell people all along the West Coast here to tune in to you guys. Thank
right
you.
Right on. You bet. You bet. Okay. I want to go back to Russ Dibo. And Russ, let's talk a little bit more about Trudeau and his impact to Indigenous leaders and others in Canada. And I know that many Indigenous people praise Trudeau for his work on reconciliation. What can you say about that? Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, my friend, the late Arthur Manuel, who was a leader who passed away in 2017, wrote a book called The Reconciliation Manifesto. He had lived long enough to see the first year of Trudeau's election and promotion of that. And he pointed it out from his point of view, it's fake reconciliation. And he was right. Like I said, basically the Liberals, I think, get top marks for their communication strategies. You know, there was a document that used to float around saying that the federal government uses a communication strategy called SWAT, Special Words and Tactics. And the purpose of federal communications is to convince the public and to control the information to force, you know, the First Nations they're negotiating with to take a reasonable position in negotiations based on the government's positions. And I think that's basically how reconciliation and nation to nation, as they called it, has worked in Canada. It even the term Indigenous peoples, you know, masks in Canada, in the Constitution of Canada, the new Constitution from 1982, unlike in the U.S., they have Section 35. That section says the existing Aboriginal treaty rights of Aboriginal peoples are hereby recognized and affirmed. And, you know, they had constitutional talks in the 80s that failed trying to define what that meant. So the courts have defined that. And Aboriginal peoples in Canada is defined as Indians, Inuit, and Métis. So when you use the term Indigenous peoples, you're masking the differences, the historical and legal facts between the different classes of, you know, Indigenous peoples. And that's what Trudeau has done. He's passed all this Indigenous legislation. He's taken an Indigenous approach. But for First Nations, it's basically watering down inherent and treaty rights into this broad generic term of Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And that's what the reconciliation approach has been. It's been a pan-Indigenous approach. And it has, you know, it hasn't advanced First Nations rights, in my view. It's watered them down. Even the Child and Family Services Act that was passed by the Trudeau government defines band councils and Indigenous governments as Indigenous governing bodies. And so basically under that law, they have federal delegated authority to pass laws over child and family services, child welfare. It's not based on, you know, Section 35 rights, you know, Aboriginal or treaty rights. So the government's still controlling. They're using, Canada has two constitutions. You know, the first one was the British North America Act, an act of the British Parliament in 1867. Section 9124 of that act says that the federal parliament has exclusive legislative authority over Indians and lands reserved for Indians. Mm-hmm. So that's the head of power they used to pass the Indian Act 148 years ago. And they're still using that under legislation. Now it's Indian legislation, First Nation legislation, Indigenous legislation, but it's still the federal parliament passing laws, kind of like in the States with Congress assuming plenary power over the tribes. It's parliamentary supremacy in Canada where they're using that Section 9124 to pass laws over Indians, First Nations, and Indigenous peoples now. And
Russ,
that's what the Trudeau government's using to control and manage us.
Okay. So, Russell, what do you think Trudeau could have done differently? What could he have done specifically with regard to some of these Indigenous issues that you're pointing out that could have allowed him to keep his job?
Well, I think he could have. Even Jody Wilson-Raybould, who was the Indigenous Justice Minister that he fired in the end, he was promoting a national law called the Indigenous Rights Recognition Act. And she was trying to have input into that, and he ignored her. And he pushed his bureaucrats' interpretation of what that means. And it meant, you know, basically, like I said, to move Indian bands into becoming Indigenous municipalities. She wrote, I understand, an 80-page document, which we never got to see because of cabinet secrecy. But she was disagreeing with the approach, but he ignored her and eventually fired her. And I think that's the problem, is he listened to the bureaucracy who didn't want to give up control and management over Indians or First Nations. And he just maintained that colonial approach. The big problem was he said that he was endorsing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but instead of recognizing the international minimum standards in that document, he came with a federal law to define it and a national action plan to define it, which is just using their status quo policies of self-government and land claims. He could have been more, honest and saying, okay, we're going to recognize the international right of self-determination for Indigenous peoples, and we're going to negotiate, you know, broader terms for land rights instead of these land claims policies, which, by the way, date back to 1973. It was his father that brought those land claims policies in, because Justin's father was prime minister before him.
Right. Yeah, he comes from a legacy, a political legacy family, certainly. We're going to take another break. We're going to come back, and we still have the phone lines open, so we sure would like to get some more calls going. Join us, 1-800-996-2848.
Looking to exhibit, enhance, or share your artistic talents and cultural knowledge? Crazy Horse Memorial has artist residencies, performance opportunities, and more. Application deadline is January 31st at crazyhorsememorial.org, who support this show.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Thank you.
You're listening to Native America Calling. Plenty of time still to join this conversation about Trudeau and Indigenous people in Canada. Please join us with comments and questions. All you need to do is pick up that phone and call 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. You give us a call, it'll connect you with our producers in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we'll put your comments on the air. So join us, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go back to Matthew Wildcat in Edmonton, Alberta. And Matthew, let's talk a little bit about immigration policy under Justin Trudeau. During Donald Trump's first term here in the States, Trudeau was seen at times as an antithesis to Donald Trump, and he said he would welcome immigrants into Canada. How did those policies resonate with Indigenous communities?
That's a good question, actually. There's never not. So one of the ways in which I think colonial rule works is that, you know, minority groups are pitted against each other, right? And even minority is not the term that I want to use, but I, you know, groups who are not in the dominant position are pitted against one another, right? And so I think, you know, part of the, you know, there sometimes can be a sentiment in Indigenous communities that, you know, why are we worrying about people from other parts of the world? We should be worrying about Indigenous peoples first, right? But it's a false decision, right? At the end of the day, if we're going to see a world that's decolonized, you know, where Indigenous sovereignty and jurisdiction is properly recognized and space is made for it, it's also going to involve dealing in a fair and just manner with the ways in which you know, the Western world has created these kind of like deep harms and inequalities in other parts of the world, right? And part of the legacy of that is that people seek to move to live in different parts of the world, right? And so, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there is, if this legacy around immigration, if, you know, if you just did a kind of a basic poll, that there would be some skepticism in Indigenous communities, but I also think there would be, you know, many like kind of leading Indigenous thinkers and voices, I think are, you know, part of what Indigenous peoples are calling for is a world in which where everyone is treated justly, you know, and that means on all levels, right? It can't just be about focusing on one issue. We have to deal with all of these issues simultaneously.
Matthew, Indigenous people make up about 5% of the population in Canada, but they have the highest incarceration rates of any other population group. Do you feel Trudeau has addressed the high incarceration rates for Indigenous people?
No, that definitely wasn't one of his priority areas. And in fact, you know, kind of one of the main mechanisms to deal with this is what they call GLADGEU reports, right? And so what these reports do is when people are being sentenced, that they take into account people's life history and background for First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. And they attempt to paint a bigger picture of you know, potential abuses and harms that people experience, which led them into situations, you know, that bring them into contact with the criminal justice system, right? And so, you know, this I believe it came about in the late 90s, maybe 99, and you know, so it's fairly well trodden. But even something like that feels like there's a pushback against it recently, and I think some people feel that it's being abused. I think some people sometimes feel that people who have maybe more tenuous claims to indigeneity are using these reports to get more lenient sentences, and so there's all these problems with it. But it's, you know, when I think about the kind of key defining topics that Justin Trudeau has attempted to push forward, it's definitely, I think, water and child welfare are the top of mind to my mind.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. I'm going to go back to the phones where we have Rick, who is listening online in Winnipeg. Hello, Rick. You are on the air.
All right. Thank you so much. You know, there are those who would suggest that the Liberal Party has done a good job about bringing Indigenous peoples into its fold. They have an Indigenous caucus. Some of its MPs are allegedly Indigenous, although they've run into trouble with that and of late. And so I'm just wondering how you each both feel about the job that the Liberal Party has done in terms of incorporating Indigenous participants, and the extent to which that may or may not have had a positive impact on policy.
All right, great question, Rick. The Liberal Party and its track record with regard to Indigenous participation. Russ, I'm going to have you respond first, and then we'll go to Matthew.
Well, full disclosure, I was one of the ones in 1990 that helped create the Aboriginal Liberal Commission in the Liberal Party of Canada. Before we quit because of Jean Chrétien breaking the promises in the Liberal platform back there. And when we developed the Constitution for the Aboriginal Peoples Commission of the Liberal Party of Canada, it had self-identification as one of the criteria, but it also had connecting criteria that, you know, you had to be recognized by the community and you had to have a credible basis for saying that you were Aboriginal, or now they say Indigenous. And that's been abused since the Trudeau government was in. The co-chair of that commission just before the 2021 election, hours before, had to resign because it was found out the Bloc Québécois, the Quebec party in Canada, was going to expose her during the leaders' debates and accuse Trudeau of basically promoting a pretendian. And she resigned, and the media reported the story. And her claim to Indigenous ancestry went back to the late 1600s or early 1700s. She had an ancestor. And based on that, she said she was Aboriginal. Mm. And there's been a lot of that going on, including one of the cabinet ministers, Bosano, I think his name was, from Alberta. He claimed to be Indigenous because he said his family that he'd been adopted into, his grandmother was a Métis, and then they were clarifying and found out it was family lore, and it wasn't true. And he wound up having to resign from cabinet recently.
Okay.
So there's been a lot of problems with this pan-Indigenous approach and self-identification and people claiming to be Indigenous who aren't and who are getting recognition.
We're dealing in the States just as often, for sure. Matthew, I'd like you to respond as well to our caller with regard to the Liberal Party's track record.
Yeah, I actually, just sat on a committee in the summer where someone examined the track record in depth. And so, you know, the conclusion of that research from Chad Cowie, who's a professor at the University of Toronto, is that, like, at a numbers level, you have absolutely seen more Indigenous participation in the electoral politics of Canada, but at a substantive level, there hasn't been any sort of significant change. And Canada, but also the Liberal Party, is kind of caught in this conundrum where they like to think they can wipe everything away with democracy and don't want to kind of grapple with, being a colonial country. You know, I will say, in fairness to the Liberals, Jamie Batiste, who is the head of their Indigenous caucus, has been elected, I think, for at least two terms. This is a pretty legitimate person. Like, his parents are very, like, actually world-renowned Indigenous scholars. His mom being a global leader on Indigenous education, and his dad being a global leader on, the global Indigenous rights movement. I don't want to throw the Liberals entirely under the bus, but it is really hard to kind of like hang your hat on something super substantive that they've done. Every despite all the gains, mm-hmm. There's still deep inequality for Indigenous peoples in this country.
Well, let's look ahead, Matthew, and the next prime minister, whoever that might be, whether it is a member of the Conservative Party or someone else, what should Indigenous people expect? What should they be prepared to advocate for?
Oh, yeah. With Pierre Poilievre, it's probably we're going to go, you know, it's not going to be a good situation. This is somebody who it will probably ride a wave of populist sentiment to power. And at the end of the day, you know, even despite opinion polling, which wherein Canadians say that they're strongly in favor of supporting Indigenous rights, you know, usually you'll get like kind of high 60s, maybe even 70% if you have a good poll of you know, everyday Canadians who say they're in favor of, you know, of recognizing Indigenous rights. They only do that on the when they get to dictate the terms of how that recognition takes place, right? And so, you know, when it comes to the brass tacks of like actually having to negotiate with Indigenous peoples, what it would look like to have, you know, a treaty relationship recognized, what it would look like for, you know, decolonization to take place, where you have things like, you know, the return of land and effective governing authority, then, you know, the Canadian public at the end of the day is very hostile to Indigenous peoples, ultimately, when it comes down to it, I think. And so, with Pierre Poilievre, he is going to bring out the worst sentiments of the Canadian public and society when it comes to dealing with Indigenous peoples. And certainly some of these monies have been set aside, like, you know, one that hasn't been come up in the media, but I know there's, I think around 17 billion dollars that have been set aside to negotiate these deals and treaties 4, 5, and 6 that people call cows and plows agreements. You know, that money is probably going to go, is be gone. All the money that's been set aside to negotiate a child welfare deal, that's probably all going to be gone as well. And so it's, you know, we're probably not looking towards the brighter future. With a Poilievre government, and even with the Liberals, it's hard to say, you know, how strongly they're going to want to hang their hat on advancing, you know, work with Indigenous people. So.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. Russ, I want to go back to you, and let's talk also about the future. And what are you hearing from different First Nation, Métis, and Inuit leaders in Canada about going forward?
Well, in the media, a lot of the leaders are saying that they hope, they're saying that Trudeau set the standard as prime minister, and they're hoping the next prime minister will follow his approach of including Indigenous peoples in the decision-making of the government, affecting policy and legislation, and also addressing the needs of housing, education, child welfare, and so on, continuing that work. But I think the way it's going with the polls, I think we're going to see a majority Conservative government coming in. And I think it's going to parallel a lot of what the tribes in the U.S. are going to face under Trump over the next 4 years, is a Conservative government in Canada will be cutting spending of programs. They're going to be promoting what Poilievre calls economic reconciliation. He wants to build another pipeline through northern B.C., mm-hmm. So he's going to be big on resource extraction, and he's going to want to remove any impediments like environmental restrictions. He says he's going to respect the duty to consult, which is a legal standard in Canada, but the duty to consult is tied to what they call strength of claim, and most bands don't have the cultural and historical evidence to meet the legal tests, you know, this Section 35 common law tests. And that means they'll just get a notice, so we're going to do logging or we're going to do mining exploration. Most bands don't have the evidence to push back and say, wait, you're going to impact on our rights. So that's going to lead to, I think, more resource extraction. Under Harper, you saw a lot of protests. That's where I Don't Know More grew up, was under Stephen Harper, you know, the movement that spread from Canada into the U.S. and around the world. of people demanding more environmental protection and recognition of Indigenous rights. And that kind of morphed into rock the vote with Trudeau. And, you know, the I Don't Know More movement kind of ended when Trudeau came in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of disillusionment now, 9 years later. I don't think you're going to see as many people proclaiming the Liberals are the way to go.
Okay.
But they're a better choice than the Conservatives. And the Conservatives, like I said, are going to parallel Trump, I think. So you're going to see parallel approaches to Indigenous policy on both sides of the border.
Russ, let me ask you one more question. We have about a minute before we have to wrap up. The current talk by incoming Donald Trump presidency, Canada needs to become the 51st U.S. state. What do you hear from tribal leaders with talk like that? What's their response?
So far, crickets. I haven't really heard a lot of them address that issue. But here in the East, you know, we had the War of 1812, and it was, you know, First Nations who fought along the British against the Americans invading the U.S., which is why we have the current border that exists now that Trump wants to erase. But there were thousands of people that died, First Nations people, so there's a lot of blood spilled over being allies of the British and, you know, eventually treaties and that, which make up what Canada is today. So I don't know how the leaders are going to address it, but, you know, it is something that affects all First Nations, including this Canada-US-Mexico agreement.
Absolutely.
There's a very narrow clause in there affecting exemptions for Indigenous peoples. I don't think the National Congress of American Indians really looked at that. It really only affects Canada, and it's a very narrow interpretation.
All right. So, okay, we're going to have to wrap up the show. Great conversation. Big thanks to Russ Dibeau and Matthew Wildcat for leading us through some of these developments, some of these political issues in Canada with the resignation of Justin Trudeau. Please join us again tomorrow for a look at affordable housing solutions for Native Americans. Until then, I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Have a great day.
Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference, February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at indian-affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
Sea Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. Sea Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.